Boker Tov and welcome. Today is the story of synthesis. Story of synthesis, focusing on a man who embodies this synthesis and whose letter also reflects this. But let's begin this story of synthesis in 1820. 1820, a child is born, and his name is Azriel in Halberstadt. This young man grows up and studies with two great rabbinic personalities of the generation of the 19th century. One was Rav Yaakov Ettlinger is the author of multiple Sfarim that are well known in the world of the yeshivas. I guess you would call him a traditional rabbinic Torah personality. And the other Rebbe of this young man, of Azriel, is a man by the name of Chacham Bernays, who was a rabbi in Hamburg, in Germany. But Chacham Bernays was a very different style than Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, who wrote tshuvas and a commentary on the Gemara and traditional Torah, I guess, rabbinic literature. Chacham Bernays had studied in the university in Würzburg and was knowledgeable in secular disciplines. So this man, this young man, Azriel, is exposed to, in his two rabbinic mentors, in Rav Yaakov Ettlinger and Chacham Bernays, two different approaches to learning, and he synthesizes them. And he becomes known as the Gaon Rav Azriel Hildesheimer, who is a rabbi in various communities, but most importantly for us, he takes this notion of synthesis, of combining different models of learning, a traditional, time-honored Torah, I guess you would say Torah-only, even though it wasn't exactly Torah-only. If you want more on Rav Azriel Hildesheimer, there's a beautiful essay with a lengthy explanation by Dr. Schneer Lyman. But that idea of a Torah prism through which we look at learning. And then another view with an academic perspective on learning and synthesizing those and harmonizing them and bringing them together. And in October, on October 22nd, 1873, Rav Azriel Hildesheimer opens a yeshiva. And for the next 24 years, Rav Azriel Hildesheimer, who is highly regarded by poskim and rabbinic personalities all across Europe, across the world, he was recognized as a Gaon. He leads a yeshiva of a unique style that has great Torah personalities and synthesizes different kinds of learning. I want to share with you, there was a student in the yeshiva whose name is Shimon Tzvi. We'll call him right now Reb Shimon Tzvi. Reb Shimon Tzvi studies in the yeshiva, and he was interviewed later in life by an interviewer. I'm going to pull it up and read it to you. He was interviewed in a Hebrew newspaper called Hadoar. He was interviewed by a woman by the name of Ilana Bialik. So this man, who when he was a bachur, he learned, when he was a young man, he learned in the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary. It was known as Beis Medrash LaRabbanim, but it was called after Rav Azriel Hildesheimer, the founder. So she asked him, the interviewer, what distinguished the Beis Medrash LaRabbanim in Berlin, where you learned? And he said, there, they expected of the students that they would also attend university. These young men who were going to be Talmidei Chachamim and Rabbanim and serve throughout Germany, they called them the the ABCs, like all Beck, Karl Bach, like all the different Rabbanim in German communities in the early part of the 20th century. I don't want to say all, because you can never say all, but the vast majority of them learned the Beis Medrash Rabbanim. All these students also attended college, also attended university. Ef Shar Haya, it was impossible, says Shimon Tzvi. It was impossible to be accepted into the Beis Medrash unless you were also a university student. And he said, where did this come from? This comes from a particular approach of German scholars, rooted very much also in a man by the name of Rav Hirsch, who was also connected to Rav Yaakov Ettlinger and Chacham Bernays, of Torah. That was the Shita of Torah im Derech Eretz. That was what he called Shiluv, a synthesis of Tarbut Klalit Chilonit im Limud HaTorah. Why? He says, because without this concept of synthesis, they did not think that the students, the Rabbanim, would be able to influence the community. They didn't think that they would be effective as rabbinic leaders, because most of the Balabatim in the communities that they're going to serving, they were Balei Tarbut Gvoha, Rofim, Madanim, doctors and professionals. And so if the Rabbanim weren't educated in this perspective of synthesis, how are they going to relate to the intellectual level of the Balabatim? And he said, so in that respect, it was Muvan Me'elav. And therefore he said, every German rabbi had this perspective of synthesis. That's the way this Talmud described what was going on in the Beis Medrash L'Rabbanim. At the same time, the Rabbanim, the Magidei Shir, were some of the most well-known Talmidei Chachamim. Rav Azriel Hildesheimer was succeeded by a man whose name is Rav David Zvi Hoffman, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. Rav David Zvi Hoffman was the author of the Malamed Lahol, a series of Tshuva Sfarim that's widely recognized. He was a recognized gadol across Europe. But even within the yeshiva, there was an element of synthesis, because they also taught Hebrew language and Tanakh and Chumash, which you would not find. I mean, the Netziv gave a weekly Chumash here in Voloshin, but they didn't teach Hebrew language. They didn't teach Parshanut regularly, and certainly in Voloshin, the students didn't go to university at all. This is the story of synthesis that starts with the founder of the yeshiva, continues with Rav David Zvi Hoffman, is suffused within the Talmidim, who then go out to become rabbis of congregations, who connect with and inspire the spiritual growth of their congregants. It's a story of synthesis. And it's taking place primarily in Germany with a highly acculturated population. This Bacher, this student in the yeshiva, Shimon Tzvi, was himself the son of a rabbi who embodied and modeled this synthesis. Shimon Tzvi was the son of a Rav. And as I was preparing for today, I had the opportunity to read Rav Shimon Tzvi's, his what he calls a filial memoir that he wrote. He published it in 1981. And it's mamish, so beautiful, what he writes about his father and how he writes about his father and the reverence and the awe and the respect that comes through in this description of his father and how his father was an internationally recognized Rav who was born and raised in a yeshiva in an intellectual milieu in Hunsdorf, in Germany, and then he went to the yeshiva at the beginning of the 20th century, in Pressburg. Anybody know why the name Pressburg is very significant? Because that was one of the greatest yeshivas, you could call it, let's say, think about the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The Chassam Sofer, the famous Rav Moshe Sofer, was the founder of this yeshiva in Pressburg, and was under the aegis of his descendants. This was, you know, one of the most prominent yeshivas that there was. So this young man His name was Avram, but in English, his name was Adolf. So this young man goes to study first in Hunsdorf, and then he goes to study in Presburg. But after that, where does he go? He goes to Bern University. And he follows his intellectual curiosity. And he creates a synthesis. He also, by the way, interestingly, this Rav was also very active in the Zionist movement in the 20th century, exchanging letters with Max Nordau and others. It was a very recognized Talmud Chacham who was involved in Zionist activities. Connected with he was not the only Hungarian Rav to be involved in Zionism. That's a whole other parsha, interestingly. He first becomes a Rav in Salzburg, and then he becomes a Rav for 18 years, starting in 1920, of the German community of Trier, T-R-I-E-R. I think it's probably pronounced something else, but we'll call it Trier or something like that. Trier is, if you look at a map, it's all the way in the western edge of Germany in the Rhine Valley. This is one of the oldest Jewish communities in Europe. You know, the Rhine Valley, right now we're in the middle of Sfiras HaOmer. We're commemorating the massacres during the Crusades of the communities in the Rhine Valley. You're talking about 1,000-year-old institutional community. He wrote a history of this community. He published widely. His name was Rabbi Adolf Altman. The sad part of the story is that in 1938, he was remaining with his community during those difficult years, and finally in 1938, he had a daughter who was living in Holland, in Holland, so he felt that there was nothing left to do, so he ran away to Holland. He went to a place called Scheveningen. The only reason I know how to pronounce that name is because my grandmother, Alei HaShalom, when she was a girl and her mother was one of five sisters, they were living in Leipzig. Even though she was Polish, their family was living in Germany. One night, she told me, before she passed away a couple of years ago now, she told me she remembered the Nazi youth marching outside their house in Leipzig. And one night, her father and all the five sisters, they decided they were going to leave. He had a business. He just locked the door. They got on a train, and they went. And she told me she was a little girl, and she was in Scheveningen, which was actually not uncommon in the 1930s. There were tens of thousands of German refugees who went to the Netherlands. So my grandmother was there in Scheveningen. He became a prominent Rav in Scheveningen. He was giving shiurim in different Bati Medrash, Rabbi Altman. But unfortunately, he was picked up and sent to a transit camp called Westerbork. But because of different interventions on his behalf, he was an internationally recognized man. Instead of being sent directly to Auschwitz, which was where most, if people were in Westerbork, they usually, most of them either went directly to Auschwitz or they went to Bergen-Belsen. But he, because he was a distinguished personality, he was sent to Theresienstadt. But his health deteriorated significantly when he got to Theresienstadt, and he only stayed there for a period of time. In July of 1944, he was sent to Auschwitz. And if you look, actually, I went to the Yad Vashem website because it's such a moving story, like the loss of people like this. It's just, it's E.F. Shalishire, the number of publications that he wrote and his history that he did and the people that he was mourning and everything. So here, there's a page of testimony that he arrived in Auschwitz in the summer of 1944. His wife was killed right away, and he was in a work camp, but his health had deteriorated very badly, and he passed away. He died in the bunk. So what one of the people wrote to his son, Reb Shimon Tzvi, that the people were so careful about him that because he was a Chashev Rav, I don't know how they got this, but they got water to do a tahara on him. He said before they took him, Lo Aleinu, over there to be cremated, they did a tahara on him. So that just that he should have some form of Kever Yisrael. So he dies. Rabbi Altman dies in 1944. So he is another living embodiment of synthesis, of being able to be a person who is steeped in traditional Torah, but also be comfortable conversant and even recognized in the world of academia. I have here an article about him. I wanted to bring some of the quotes that people write about him, but I can't read them because they're all in German. And you have to like put them all into the Google Translate of how people held him in such high regard, not just from his learning, but also from his historical scholarship. He wrote the authoritative scholarly history of the Jewish community of Trier. That's where he served as the Rav for 18 years. He wasn't just the Rav. He was also an academic. Yes?
A quick question. So I'm assuming in the late 1800s, early 1900s in Germany, there were no quotas in universities?
The question here was about quotas in universities. I'm not familiar with that from an academic standpoint, but there were, I don't know if there were formal quotas, but there were lots of Jews. And if you think back over the course of this year of Rabbanim that we've spoken about during this 20th century period who studied in universities, right? But in specific, what I wanted to focus on this morning is that this was a shita. This was an approach. This was a mahalach that you intentionally, bedavka, synthesize and make a choice to include both of these in your personality. This was Rav Israel Hildesheimer's vision. This was the rabbinical seminary. This was the person of Rabbi Altman, Hashem Yikom Damo Zechus Yagen Aleinu. And this is the personality of his son, Shimon Zvi. Who is Shimon Zvi? Shimon Zvi is none other than Professor Alexander Altman. The man who has published nearly 250 scholarly articles, who served at Brandeis University for over a half a century. He came there in 1958. He retired in 1976. No, he was there for 20 years. Before that, he was 20 years. In England as a rav and a professor. And after, he died in 1987. But after he left Brandeis, he wasn't a formal professor. He was a professor emeritus. He was then a visiting professor at Harvard, Hebrew U, and then an associate professor at the Harvard University Center of Jewish Studies. Who was Alexander Altman? He was a man who was raised both personally and intellectually in this culture of synthesis. And so what did he bring to the world? He brought to the world the model of himself being an Orthodox rabbi and being a celebrated professor in a secular American university, Brandeis University. A recognized, accomplished academic. You can go online. You can pull articles. Many of them are in English. Many of them are in German. He was a man of synthesis. So he was born in Kozic, which is a small town in Slovakia. That's where his parents got married. So he was born in Kozic. Where did he go to learn as a young man? This is Shimon Zvi, who was interviewed in the newspaper in the 1960s to talk about what his life was about. He says, I went to the Beis Medrash Lerabbanim in Berlin. In 1931, it was the same year that he got smicha from the Beis Medrash Lerabbanim in Berlin, and he also got his doctorate on the philosophy of Max Scheler. It's the same synthesis. He actually started his own Beis Medrash in Berlin, called Beis Medrash Al Shem HaRambam, and he was a teacher, a lecturer in the Beis Medrash Lerabbanim. That was the picture that I sent out in the email, went out early this morning. This picture, so this is the picture of the Beis Medrash Lerabbanim of Berlin. So on the top are all the students, and you can see the very modern dress. And then on the bottom are the Rabbanim. So in the middle, this is Rav David Zvi Hoffman. In the middle, farther over from him is the Sridi Eish, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, which we haven't talked about this year, but Amir Tzashem, we will do that. And then here is, you see on the bottom, Dr. A. Altman. He was a Rebbe in the yeshiva where he learned. He was a recognized tremendous Talmud Chacham. This is a picture of Rav Azriel Hildesheimer. This is an article from the Leo Beck, published by the Leo Beck Institute. This is Rav Azriel Hildesheimer. This is what we could call the Big Four. This was Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the Sridi Eish. This is Rabbi Joseph Wolgamuth, for a different discussion at a different time. This is Rav David Zvi Hoffman and Rabbi Moses Auerbach. Auerbach, famous German rabbinic family name. So it's Auerbach, Karl Bach, like tons of rabbinic families. They're all running through the Beis Medrash L'Rabbanim in Berlin. And so they're bringing to the world this perspective of synthesis. Oh. So now that we can appreciate the ideal of synthesis that Professor Altman was raised in, we can understand his life. So he goes to the Beis Medrash L'Rabbanim in Berlin. He gets smicha and he gets his doctorate. He begins teaching in the Beis Medrash L'Rabbanim and establishes his own Beis Medrash. Then in 1938, he is still in Berlin, but his father is in Trier. His father goes to the Netherlands. He's able to get a document that he can go with his wife, and I think he had one child or two children at that time, and go to England. So he ends up in England when the war breaks out in 1939. His parents are in the Netherlands, and he's trying to get them out. He's not successful, as we noted. Meanwhile, he's in England. He stays there till 1958 as essentially the communal rabbi, but also founding the Institute of Jewish Studies, an academic institution focusing on an academic perspective on Judaism. So here he is bringing to life in England these two parts of his personality. Then he comes to America and his rabbinic career, so to speak, takes a back seat to his teaching and publishing at Brandeis and then at Harvard. But when Ben-Gurion sends him a letter and says, "Can you give me your opinion on this question of who is a Jew?" He's writing to someone who is a living embodiment of a particular Masorah, of a particular tradition. This is what he saw in his parents' home. This is what he saw his father give his life to. This is what he saw his institution. And this is what he lived. So it's interesting to me that when he received this letter, if you look on in the article, if you have the Hebrew in front of you, if you look on the top of the letter, do you notice how he writes back to him? First of all, of course, he writes in Hebrew. But how does he sign his name? This is what intrigued me. You see what it says on the top of the letter? Who is the sender? Shin Tsadi Alexander Altman. Shin Tsadi Alexander Altman. Which you don't get, by the way, coming through in the English translation. But in the Hebrew, he signs it Shin Tsadi Alexander. Why? Who's Shin Tsadi? Shimon Tzvi! Shimon Tzvi! He said, Ben Gurion, it's a Hebrew letter. This is a correspondence. So he's known as Alexander. That was his famous professorial title. That's how he went by. I don't know what his friends called him. Maybe they called him Al. But he says, Shin Tsadi, Alexander Altman. And even in the signature, Vohokara Rabba, it was very telling to me that he wanted Ben Gurion to know that he is Shin Tsadi, Alexander. He's the synthesis of his Jewish name, of his Hebrew name, of his given name, and his secular name.
So based on this, he was already at Brandeis.
Yes, exactly. Which is interesting, because if you look online, it sounds like from some of the biographies that he arrived in Brandeis in 1958. It's clearly not the case, because this letter is dated from December of 1958. It sounds like he got there in 1959. This letter is dated 1958, December 15th, so he was clearly already in Waltham, Massachusetts. But it's the idea that he represents this synthesis, right? Isn't it interesting that he doesn't just sign his name Alexander? That's how he was known. Yeah?
He also didn't date it just with a Hebrew date.
Right. He dates it also with a Hebrew date. Okay. So now, he starts off the letter, the first chunk of the letter, by discussing the nature of the question of Jew and the definition of the word Jew. And he makes a suggestion that maybe you can get rid of having to write down the nationality of someone on their registration card. That's the first thing he says. Look, the best thing is, let's not get into this whole situation. You have a child. The child is not halachically Jewish. So don't get involved in writing Jewish or not Jewish on his registration card. What do you have to get involved with that for? But he says, look, if you have to get involved in that, I'll tell you what I think. So here we go. Lefi da'ati. It's the bottom of the first page in the Hebrew, and it is in English. The problem with the mask is you can't lick your finger. You end up licking the mask, and you're just like going like this. So it doesn't really work. In my opinion, so it's the bottom of, it's on the top of 225, the right-hand column. You see where it says, in my opinion. So this is obviously a different model of synthesis, of unity, of bringing things together. But it's interesting that he uses the same concept. In my opinion, the inseparable unity of nationality and religion is one of the essential characteristics of Judaism. You cannot separate religion and nation. Le'umius vadatius, nationality and religion. They are one and the same. Who does he look to as a model for this? What is the holiday that we are counting toward? Shavuos. In Shavuos, we tell the story of creating a Jewish identity. Who creates a Jewish identity on Shavuos? Right, Rus. So what does she say? Professor Altman says, he says, this is the core. This is the shoresh. Go down five lines. All right, you have to, in the English, turn the page. Turn it over to 226. Where is it here? Where is it? I have it here in the Hebrew. No, I'm sorry. Stay on 225. Stay on 225 in the English. Halfway down. V'toldos ha'am v'odas olos b'kona echad. Ruas ha'moaviyah. I can't figure out why. Oh, there it is. Ruth of Moab. It's in the seventh line on the paragraph on 225. There it is. Ruth ha-Moaviyah. Ruth, hevia es ritzona, expressed her interest, her desire, lehidabek ba'am Yisrael, to cleave and connect to the Jewish people, vidaso, and its religion, ba'omra, was saying, amech ami velokayech elokai. Your people, your nation is my nation, and your God is my God. Am ve'elokav, says Professor Altman, the nation and its God, tzmudim ze bazeh, they are melded together. Ve'ein lahafrid bein hadvekim. You can't split among them. You can't split between them. It is true, he says, of course, this type of unity is found among other peoples in the ancient Middle East. How is he looking at this now? Not just from a religious perspective, but from an academic perspective, from a historical perspective. However, in Israel, there was further created the religious idea of Bechiras Yisrael, the election of Israel. The nation was consecrated from birth for a religious universal role, which constitutes the great and glorious destiny of the nation. This idea is the outstanding feature in the history of the Jewish spirit and all its currents and manifestations from the days of the Bible and early rabbinic literature to the medieval philosophers and Kabbalists. Its vigor has not abated to this day. There is no ignoring the fact that modern secularization in Christian nations brought about a separation of religion and nationality. Nevertheless, neither the nationalism nor the religion of these Christian nations was damaged in the course of this development. Their unity was but an historical accident which occurred at a given time due to the conquest of the nation and its subjugation to the church, not something traditional and organic, as was the case with the Jewish people. Says Professor Altman, you might have Christian countries, right? You might have states that have a religion. You might have nations that have a religious identity. But he said that's accidental or incidental. It is not inherent. For the Jewish people, there is a synthesis of nation and religion that cannot be split apart. He talks about Franz Rosenzweig, who he wrote about a lot. We'll skip to the next page. Go over to the next section. And he talks about how these things go together. Top of the second page. The more a Jew tries to understand his Torah and God, the more he will understand his nationhood. The entire national strength of the people of Israel stems from the unity of religious faith and will for the national survivor. Whoever tampers, if you try to split apart, he says, between the nation and the religion, whoever tampers, as it were, with the pupil, with this unity, tampers with the pupil of the nation's eye. Bavas eno. This is a rabbinic expression. So here again, you have a turn of phrase which is indicating the synthesis of Professor Altman, where he's using, you know, Franz Rosenzweig and an academic perspective on history, but with rabbinic inflections, both in terms of the language and in terms of the ideal. He now talks about the importance, in the next paragraph, which you can read on your own, the importance from a practical standpoint of revival of the state of Israel, how it's even more important in this day to make sure that the unity of these things go together. And he thinks that the idea of bringing up new names like Ivri is a bad idea. I want to close with one last footnote here at the end. Turn to the last paragraph, which adds, I think, a beautiful coda to his discussion. You know, when I thought about preparing for this morning, there were so many pieces of this puzzle, and I was thinking to myself, what do I want to say? What do I hope that you're going to walk away with? So my hope was that you'll understand that there is a masora of synthesis. That's what I was hoping for. But that masora of synthesis, I think, has multiple layers, right? There is the theological layer, there is the ideological layer, and then there's the human layer, which is that a person who is an academic, you could see them just from a caricature standpoint as cold, calculated, distant. But someone who is a Rav, someone who is a Morah Derech, a Morah D'Asra, someone who is responsible for taking care of the spiritual needs of Jews, there's a big piece of that which is in the heart. Synthesis of the Beis Medrash and the academy, of traditional learning, of the role of a Rav and the role of an academic, they are synthesized not just theological and intellectually, but also from an experience standpoint. And this is where he closes, which is so interesting. He says, in conclusion, I wish to emphasize one more thing. Obviously, the Rabbanut, the Israeli rabbinate, has to be free to deal as it sees fit with all who wish to be proselytized. Meaning, you want to write your name down on the registry as a Jew, you got to have gir kahalacha. There's no compromising on that. One may hope that at this crossroad in which we find ourselves, when the exiles are being ingathered and the state of Israel awaits tens of thousands of Jews from Eastern Europe, the rabbis will treat the question of proselytes generously and with ease. In the Lashon of the original, they will be treating it with nedivus lev. The nedivus lev. V'yakilu. And they will be lenient. B'kabola l'toch yadus. In bringing people into Yadus. This is the Rav speaking. This is not the academic speaking. The academic says these are the categories, these are the principles, these are the applications. The Rav says, we're dealing with Jews. We're dealing with people. We're dealing with difficult scenarios. And sometimes that means we have to dafka look for kulas. I heard this myself, mipi kutchel, from Maran Rav Shkadali Dov Shvort Zecher Tzadok V'Kadosh L'Vracha, how in certain cases he was careful to look for leniencies, to pursue kulas, because of the different, difficult and exigent human circumstances. So Professor Altman is telling us, he says, look, a serious obligation is laid upon the shoulders of the rabbis to enter these children tachas kanfei hashchina, in order, why? To give them a feeling of love toward Am Yisrael, to Eretz Yisrael. I pray that the rabbis of the state of Israel will do all in their power to facilitate the complete integration of the children of whom we speak. Respectively yours, Shin Tzadi Alexander Altman. There's the academic question, and then there's the personal question. And he's saying we have to remember that synthesis also. It doesn't mean that everything goes, and it doesn't mean that you can convert people who are not up to the standard of conversion. But when we're facing a difficult circumstance, we also have to consider the human question. We have to synthesize both the intellectual query and the person who's asking this question. So Professor Altman, who is the child, and maybe you could say the poster child, for the world of synthesis, of being a staunchly orthodox, traditional rabbi, and a world-class academic, is also at the end of this letter coming back to the heart, coming back to the role of the Rav, of making sure that within the confines of halacha, we can do the best that we can to bring people in ba'avoso sa'ava, with a feeling of love, with a feeling of inclusion, with understanding the difficulties of the circumstances. This is another aspect, I think, of the tradition of synthesis. Not just bringing in, importing the academic rigor of the world of the university, but infusing that academic rigor with heart, with soul, with connection with people. Yes?
So what does it mean to be, what is he actually saying? Does that mean to tell the parents very nicely, no, I'm sorry, if they just know? Or does it mean, listen, you know, a drop of blood, just go to this class here?
So it's a good question, what does it mean practically? And I think in that sense, every case is going to be different. You know, where are the parents coming from? What is the process and what are the prospects for this child? There are lots of different shitos. There are a lot of different aspects of geiros, like there are in many areas of halacha. In many areas of halacha, there are different approaches. There are different approaches in Rishonim and in Achronim. Sometimes we are no to lahachmir. Sometimes we are no to lahakel. It depends on the circumstance. Like, even you go back ages and ages. In the days of Nehemiah, people were wantonly disregarding the rules of Shabbos. So the Gemara says in Shabbos, and then Nehemiah instituted strictures, geiros, to bring people more in line with observing Shabbos. And yet, at certain times in history, we relax those gzeiras. So there are certain things which are objective, and there are certain things which are subjective. Sometimes you have something that's called lechatchila, ideal, and sometimes it's bidyeved, not ideal. And we have a principle in halacha, shasatcha kidyeved dami. So when do you apply that idea that it's an exigent circumstance so we can rely on this shita? Well, it depends on who the author of that opinion is. If that one minority of view is the Rambam, well, that's the Rambam. If that minority view is a later authority from the 18th century that doesn't really get a lot of press in the Shulchan Aruch, so then you might not even be able to rely on that authority even in Shas Adchak. So this is where having a Masorah in Psak is so important. And that's why I come back to Rav Schwartz, because he modeled for me and for so many that balance of finding ways to the extent that is appropriate within the contours of halacha, to synthesize those aspects. Not every case was permitted. You know, certain cases that he shared with me, There was no way to solve that problem for that person. Either they had made a choice that closed off their options, or somebody else, unfortunately, had more made a choice that foreclosed their options. But a lot of times, there are solutions that we can find. It becomes more challenging when you're talking about a bureaucracy and a state and regulations and registration. But the ideal is that a posek and a rav should do exactly what Professor Altman is saying, is following the standards and the prescriptions of halacha, and within that, understanding the particular questioner who's coming to you and saying, is this a lechatchila question or is this a bidyavid question? You know, is there room for kulas? Or maybe there's not. Maybe dafka, we need to be machmer on this person so that that person can accomplish the goals that they're after. So I don't, that, which is why I don't think he's saying, you know, this is what you should do as an institution. What he's saying is, my hope is that the attitude will be one of nadiva slave. The attitude will be one of understanding. The attitude will be one of trying to come to resolutions, which I think in my case, as a young person dealing with older rabbis and dealing with difficult questions, that's what I've seen from my rabbeim. You know, tremendous sensitivity and heart in dealing with difficult questions that come their way. It doesn't mean that the answers are always easy and they're not always what people are looking for, but that's the ideal. I think that's how I see it.